I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. It's time now for a look at sports. Our very own Tony Cox is here to lead the charge. Tony, before the break, I talked about how making it can lead to big family drama. Sometimes making it won't pull you away from the dangers of the streets, will it?
That is really true. And as you know, we have seen that problem with a few athletes in the past years. And this week, Farai, that very issue has been at the core of the story of the death of Washington Redskins safety Sean Taylor. In fact, it's one of the main topics in today's Sports Bloggers Roundtable. And for that, we have Greg Lee, online sports editor for the Boston Globe. Also, Dee Will, who writes for the blog Sports on My Mind. And Jamil Hill, who writes about sports for ESPN.com. Hello, everybody.
How you doing?
Hello.
I'm doing great.
Good.
Let's start with this. You've all put your computers to the test on the Sean Taylor story over the last couple of days, as has most of the sports reporting world. Jamil, you're in Florida. The latest information seems to be fueling the debate even more over whether Taylor's past life in some way led to his shooting death. Now, we have a friend and fellow NFL athlete speaking out. So tell us, what do you know, what do we know now that's coming out of South Florida about the killing?
Well, I think what we know is just what the police said. As of now, there's nothing to suggest that Sean Taylor knew his attacker. There's also nothing to suggest this was any link to his past, nor is it anything to suggest this is anything more than a random act of violence. You know, of course, it can be random, and he can be targeted at the same time, given his wealth, his fame, and even his race, that all three of those elements certainly made him a prime target, and sadly, for violence. But I think that we need to pay attention to what the police are saying, because they're the trained investigators, and I know a lot of people are making a lot to do about what Antrell Roll said, his former teammate, saying that he had lived in fear for 3 years, which I find pretty amazing. That's a pretty long time to live in fear, and for a guy to live in fear, but yet not set his security alarm the night that this unfortunate attack took place. So, I think we need to be very judicious as the media members with how we deal with the facts, be responsible about presenting his past and about, you know, presenting our side commentary. It's nice that we all have theories about what happened, but we have to focus on the evidence and the actual truth.
Let's talk about this for a moment. Perception is everything, it's often said. And the way this story was first reported gave a lot of folks, Greg, the perception that Taylor's past conflicts with the league, his past conflicts, I should say, with the league and the law, in essence, put him in a position for something like this to happen to him. And that perception, before all the facts were in, and they're still not in, made some folks, black folks in particular, upset. Now, the Sports Task Force of the National Association of Black Journalists, which you head, was among them. Why were you upset?
I just thought, you know, just given the fact that, you know, everyone says the first impression is a lasting impression, and most people in the world don't really know who Sean Taylor was. So the first thing that people went, when the stories first came out, you know, the 24-hour news cycle, that you won't get the news out, you won't get all the information you want out there without really thinking about it. And then when the stories that came out about Sean, it made the assumption upon a lot of stories that, you know, he had a checkered past, he had run-ins with the law. So when people first read the story and thought about it, they drew conclusions that, well, he had this coming to him. So I think, you know, in a rush to get the story out, that was it.
Well, D. Will, how can you not talk about Taylor's past in reference to his violent death, whatever the actual motive of the crime turns out to be?
Well, I don't really have that much of a problem with people talking or writers mentioning his past. However, context is what's really important here. What I saw is that his past was mentioned as a way to impugn his character, rather than if it was in the context of how he is as, or was as a man now, and the changes that he went through from being a person who allegedly brandished a gun, et cetera, to doting father, having a fiance, and that kind of thing, of being more mature, doing right with the Redskins, being more open with people. He was a very shy young man and apparently was coming, opening up to people. If he were mentioned in that context, that would have been great.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you all write about sports, but here's a question that I'd like to put to each of you. But first, have either of you ever covered a police beat where you cover murders routinely?
I have. I did cops reporting. Okay. When I was in college, for 2 summers actually.
All right. So
I did it during the heat of the OJ when that incident first happened. And if I just may piggyback very quickly about something that D. Will said, is that people have to, and this is, I caught a lot of flack for saying, you know, if this were Brett Favre, they wouldn't be using his past in the way that they did Sean Taylor. And this I think is an example of the difference between how white athletes and black athletes, or even white celebrities and black celebrities, their deaths or unfortunate incidents are constructed, yep. is that white athletes are allowed to reconcile with their past. It's allowed to be something they grow from, they mature from. You know, nobody's still bringing up the fact that Brett Favre used to be a drug addict. And if they do, they're bringing it up in the context of, look how much he's grown. With Sean Taylor, it was pretty much like, he's that guy and he's no one else.
Well, here's
that was sort of my issue with that as well, because – you know, that's the incident that happened a couple of years ago.
Well,
this isn't stuff that happened last week.
Let me tell you why I'm asking that question, because it's been suggested, and I think this is interesting, that sports journalists are not very good at covering crime, and that when balancing, and that when crime and sports clash, sports writers have difficulty balancing the requirements of those two very different types of stories, especially when it comes to sensitivity. It's almost like local versus national reporting, you know, where one is often less passionate than the other. Do you buy that at all, Greg?
I agree, especially with sports columnists, because when you're a sports columnist, you become a sports columnist. You are there for your expertise. You've seen a lot of games, you've seen a lot of different situations, and experienced a lot of things in sports. Whereas when sports cross into a social thing, such as Sean Taylor being murdered, they're not equipped to do that. And I'm the first to admit that a lot of sports journalists aren't equipped to do that. And I think that, you need to take a step back and not comment on things that you're not experienced on. I think that's the most important thing. I think that's what, Jamil and D-Will was mentioning, the context of it. And I think that, in sports, it's everything, you add up, everything together in a story. Where they added up, in this case with Sean Taylor, they added up his past and he got murdered, so they added one and one, so it must have been two.
Well, does that, for you, D-Will, do you buy, first of all, do you buy that? And secondly, do you think that that is a plausible explanation for why the coverage of Taylor's death caused so much consternation?
No, actually. I do understand that columnists have a separate role to play. However, after the Associated Press article came out, the next article, the big article, was from the Washington Post. Jason LaCanfora, who's the Redskins beat writer, authored the article with two Washington Post news writers. Not only did they throw in the AP mentions of Taylor's checkered past, but they also threw in local mentions, including an incident, a traffic incident, a drunk driving incident that was thrown out of court, and it had nothing to do with anything in the case. It was actually a non-event. And to throw that in with all of the other alleged gun brandishing, et cetera, I found that to be highly irresponsible.
Well, let me ask you as one final thing before we go to our last topic, and this is for you, D. Will. Is this a matter of black folks just not wanting to face the facts?
No, not at all. Not in my opinion. The Sean Taylor murder, how it's been covered, is a very nuanced story in itself. It's being covered as Greg said, 1+1=2 story, when actually there are many, many layers to what's going on here in the reportage and in the response to the reporting. And it's our job, I feel, as black reporters, as reporters in general, because some white reporters as well have spoken out against the tenor of the reporting, negative tenor. So I feel it's our job to point that out. I feel it's our job to look at it with a jaundiced eye even. At the same time, is it the nature or the problem with black people that we can't look at ourselves? No, not at all. And we're not using it as a crutch, an excuse, or anything else. It is what it is. We're reporting what it is. And for us to deal with Sean Taylor's death and change the nature of black-on-black crime, that's a whole different issue.
All right, let's move on to another topic, because our time is running short. And we could talk about this the whole time, and maybe we will visit it again. But I do want to talk about something else that we mentioned, because we've had some discussions about it here in the office. It has to do with HBCU football. Now, last week, we saw the 34th edition of the famed Bayou Classic broadcast on NBC with Grambling State and Southern University, one of the few times a year we see a historically black college sports program featured on national television. My question, I'm coming to you, Jamel, is why this continues to be the case, because it was more understandable back when there were no cable outlets. But nowadays, some of the smaller schools in the nation can be seen on television regularly, but not the HBCUs. Why is that?
Well, I know that, I feel like ESPN put their toe, at least, in the market, because you do see HBCU games somewhat regularly on our ESPNU channel. Mm-hmm. And it used to be that they were non-existent on any of the ESPN networks, and the only place you can find it was either on BET or that annual game that you pointed out. I agree. I think it's a very untapped resource for sports networks because, case in point, the Florida Classic was here in Orlando, which featured FAMU versus Bethune-Cookman. That's one game that generates, they estimate, between, $8 and $10 million into the local economy just in one weekend. Mm-hmm. So if you're talking about it bringing that kind of dollars to a local economy, I think that would be something, a great alternative to bring to viewers. I just think that there's so many newspapers that just ignore HBCUs in terms of covering them. I don't think we do a great job of coverage in terms of our college football coverage, in general. I mean, we have a college football live program, but, you don't really see HBCUs mentioned until it's the playoffs.
And even then,
it's a scant sort of mentioning. So I think there's buying power there, there's economic power there, and the networks, I think, are doing themselves a disservice by not tapping into it.
Well, I have less than a minute left, Greg. I wanted to ask you, do you think that Grambling and Southern are the only programs worth watching on TV?
Well, I'm from New Orleans, so I'm very familiar with the Bayou Classic, and it's very, very near and dear to me. And I think there should be an opportunity for as Jamel mentioned, that ESPN has just started, tapping into that resource of showing other games around the country. But I think the problem is that they still look at, most executives look at what are the financial benefits of showing these games and what, financial impact these games bring to the communities. The Bayou Classic, it brings in millions of dollars to the city. So if HBCU games, teams had regular games like that every week, Michigan, Ohio State, or big games, big college programs, they bring in millions of dollars every week. Can't necessarily say that about HBCU games. I think that's what TV executives are looking at.
Well, D. Will, I guess I'll give you the last word. This is something maybe you should be writing about really quickly.
Absolutely. I think the economic viability on television is the problem with historically black colleges and universities. And until the producers, et cetera, and the networks find a way to tap into those dollars television-wise, it's not going to happen. We're not going to see it.
That's where we're going to have to stop. D. Will writes for the blog Sports on My Mind, talking to us from Vermont Public Radio. Greg Lee, sports editor for the Boston Globe, and Jamel Hill, writing about sports for ESPN.com, joining us from Orlando. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
And that was NPR's Tony Cox.